just keeps it from sitting under the bus. And I'll cut all that out.
Good evening. Been 2 weeks, hasn't it? I skipped out on you last week due to the flu, and looks like there's a number that are out this evening with it. Turn to the book of Leviticus, chapter 19. Leviticus 19. Our topic 2 weeks ago was the question, where did Cain get his wife? And I thought that that would be a relatively simple question to deal with, and wasn't quite aware of the Pandora box that we opened up in trying to address a consequence that flows out of that. The answer to where did Cain get his wife, he had to have married one of his sisters, or perhaps a niece, more likely one of his sisters. Sort of a sad situation in that we read that he went out from the presence of the Lord, built an anti-God civilization, and Adam and Eve had to watch not only one of their sons murdered, and the pain that comes from that, but to watch another son leave, and then if you stop and reflect upon that, a sister or a daughter leaving and going with Cain as well. So that would have been another added tragedy for the first parents to see two sons and a daughter, one killed and two apostatized from the faith. Now the issue that though flows out of the question, where did Cain get his wife, is that if he married his sister, how does this square with future revelation in the Bible, particularly in the book of Leviticus, of the Levitical laws given by God through Moses to the nation of Israel, all the priesthood and the tabernacle and everything? Those laws then forbade the marrying of one sister. And then it also, we looked at a whole list of people that were forbidden to intermarry. And how then could it be permissible to Cain and not be permissible to the later descendants of Adam's race? The basic answer that we looked at was that we reflected upon the principle that all systems of interpretation recognize, and that is known as progressive revelation. That God's revelation has not been given to us at one time covering the entire scope, but it is a historical unfolding of God's scheme of redemption. And that while that salvation has, we believe, is the same in all of the epochs or eras of historical revelation that have occurred from the garden down through Christ and the completion of the canon of Scripture known as the New Testament. While salvation is the same through that whole era, and that all men are justified by grace through faith, and we do not hold that the Bible teaches that there is one way of salvation for guilty sinners in a certain era and another way of salvation for them in another era. Several churches do teach that. All three systems of main interpretation of Scripture, known as either covenant theology, you fall into that, or new covenant theology, or dispensational theology. All of those systems, in a sound manner, affirm that salvation is the same in all eras of human history. But there have been individuals within each of those systems which have made statements which might be inferred that it is otherwise. Dispensationalist individuals have made statements that could be interpreted like that, and New Covenant theologians and Covenant theologians have all made statements that could be taken to teach that their salvation is different in different eras, but the systems themselves do not insist on that. Now, having said that that is the case, then there is also what has to be dealt with, and that is the unfolding of the history of redemption. We here in the New Testament age know far more than those in previous ages about the person and work of Jesus Christ and the bigger picture in redemption. And that has been true since the fall of man. That is, God has been progressively unfolding that. And he has spoken in times past in diverse manners through the prophets by various means of revelation. But he has in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, Hebrews 1:1-2. And this is my Son, hear ye him. This is the final completed revelation of what God would have for the human race to comprehend. So that Christ is the theme that began in the Garden of Eden after the fall, that there was to be a coming Redeemer. He is the theme throughout the Old Testament. He is the one that the prophets predicted that was to come, and that he is the one who has now come and has fulfilled all of those types and shadows that had been foretold of him. And so now then, the completed revelation, the fullest revelation that we can know of the mind of God for God's will for us, is completed in the revelation that's given to us through Jesus Christ and his apostles. Now, having said that, you would think then that it would be a relatively simple matter to determine what are the ethics or the principles of moral behavior that are to be determined for a Christian to live by. How do we determine what is right and wrong? How do we determine the will of God as expressed in his laws? Or his commandments, his statutes, his judgments. And we stated last time that there have been groups or positions of within these three camps of theology which have attempted to say, well, one way is that we can say that in light of progressive revelation, whatever is in place at this position in human history, it is still binding and authoritative unless it is replaced by new revelation. All right? So that we can then say that baptism replaces circumcision. Now, who gave the commandment to circumcise? Yeah, a little more specific, though. Moses just make it up. All right, that's who I'm looking for. God gave his law mediated through Moses, and that law was to circumcise. Now then, we baptize. Now, how then has that been changed? Because we hold then that Christ is the one who has come and that he has fulfilled the type and shadow there and has replaced the ordinance with that of baptism, that is, in the New Testament. Now then, there are other issues, and as it relates to this matter of the morality of sexuality and marriage, then the issue then that we're trying to focus on is that how then do we determine that it is still proper to refrain from marrying one's sister or one's close of kin. So the one system says everything is binding, unless it is altered by new revelation. The other position, which says, no, that won't work, there's an easier way, is that we say that nothing that is given in the previous era, let's say the Old Testament, is binding on the conscience of the Christian unless it is reaffirmed in the New Testament. Okay? One system, everything is binding unless it is nullified by New Testament revelation. Second system, nothing is binding unless it is reaffirmed by New Testament revelation. Now that may appear to be a relatively then simple way. If we happen to belong to the Church of Christ, and if they want to determine an issue, say in regard to church music, for example, what do we know that the Church of Christ believes about church music? Anybody? No instrumentation. Well, now, what is their ground for that? What's their basis for believing that it's improper to have instruments? There's nothing in the New Testament that affirms that instruments are to be used in the worship of God. If it is pointed out to them, but there was instrumental use in worship in the Old Testament, then what is the reply? It's no longer binding. Nothing that is stated in the Old Testament is of authoritatively binding on the New Testament approach to ethics and worship. So therefore, whatever is not found in the New Testament is not to be introduced into the worship of God. All right, now that is one way of handling it. And some churches go that route. The other position that we have just affirmed, though, is that everything that is found in the Old Testament revelation is still binding unless the New Testament nullifies it. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus referred to three practices of praying, of fasting, and of giving alms. Remember those passages there? When you pray, when you fast, when you do your almsgiving or your charitable giving. Now, what was he assuming was proper? Here he comes into the scene. Were there people praying in the Old Testament? Then is it proper to pray in the New Testament? See? You may say, oh, that's such a silly question. No, it's not a silly question because it's related to this. What about the matter of fasting? Did people fast in the Old Testament? Did Jesus assume it'd be proper to fast in the New Testament? Yes. The giving of alms and so forth. He's assuming that what was being practiced would be carried over. So he's not using the hermeneutic, nothing is binding unless it is reaffirmed. He's assuming there are some things that are going to be continuitous. That is, they're going to continue over from the Old Testament into the New Testament times. Now, the problem that we struggle with then is when it comes to ethics now, standards of conduct, moral obedience, what is it that binds the Christian's mind, and how do we determine which of the Old Testament laws are continuous and carry over, and which ones are discontinued, that is, discontinuous. And so that's the debate in the summation of what is known as continuity and discontinuity. I started to bring all of my library tonight of the books that I have on this particular subject. I may bring them next Wednesday night. That's why I'm a little bit late. I decided I couldn't get them all in the car. uh, I've read extensively on it, and I find that each position or each author that tries to take a simplistic approach to this leaves themselves open for criticism, because it just simply doesn't work. It looks like simplified formulas, what I've given to you. But it's not simplified if we can find examples in the Bible in which that we can't determine whether it's carried over or whether it doesn't carry over. And so let's look in the book of Leviticus chapter 19 tonight, and we're going to put these two main principles to the test to see that if they can stand the test and they provide us with a proper hermeneutic or principle of interpretation. The book of Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 19. We're going to look at the chapter in detail, but we'll look at the springboard text here in verse 19. I'm going to read it out of the New King James. I've got the Old King James here too. And there may be another translation that might be a little more helpful. Leviticus 19:19. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed. Neither shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you. Now here we have distinctions. We have God's commandment as a statute to not permit different breeds of livestock to interbreed. Secondly, to not sow agricultural seed of mixed varieties in the same field. And thirdly, not to wear garments of different cloth or material. Now, what is this affirming here? Go back to the opening chapter of the 19th chapter. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now this is addressed clearly here to the race of people, or the nation, whichever you prefer to call it, known as Israel. Now, are these commandments, these statutes, commandments that relate strictly to these people as a people, distinct from the Gentile nations, or are these commandments equally binding upon all races for all time? Now notice it is a question in verse 2 of holiness. Now there is, to add a little more difficulty to our understanding, but necessary for our understanding, one school of theology maintains that the way that to help us make these distinctions as to what carries over is to divide up the laws, the commandments, the statutes, into three divisions. Anybody know what those are? The moral law, the ceremonial law, and the judicial law. And therefore, all we have to do then is go to the Old Testament and determine what is moral, what is ceremonial, or a type. I can't get my word. Typological? Is that correct? Huh? Typology? Yes, that's two different words, though. There. You say it's the same? No, I think it is, too. Typological and typology. To be ceremonial sets forth a picture or a type. We have two ceremonies, we believe, in the New Testament, and they are baptism and the Lord's Supper. Okay? We could raise the issues right there. Are those moral? What you're raising your eyelids for? Is it a sin for a Christian to refuse to be baptized? Then that's not ceremonial, that's moral. Get it? All right, we have a ceremony, and yet it has moral implications. Bob?
All three categories with the ascended, right?
That's exactly it. Is that, here is my premise. Anytime God gives a command to any person, whether you want to call it moral, civil, or ceremonial, it becomes moral to that person or to that group of people to whom it is addressed. You understand that? Anytime God says you shall do this, if you don't do it, there's moral implications. So to just simplistically come up with this profound threefold division, that some laws are moral, some are ceremonial, and some are judicial, again, doesn't fit the whole context of Scripture. Because these laws that we're going to look at tonight, some of them can be put in a ceremonial classification. Some can be put in a moral classification, and some can be put in a social or civil classification. And yet, I guarantee you, you let any Israelite refuse to obey any one of these laws, and it's a sin, and may even be a capital offense. So, we can't just make these neat little boxes and say this is the way we're going to solve the issue. And let's now go through this chapter and observe this. Now let me ask a question in regard to verse 19. The shirt I have on this evening here is a mixed garment. Am I sinning against my God by wearing this garment? Now, if you're going to make a yes or no answer, give me your reason why that is the case.
Well, that's hard.
It's a hard one? Well, let's go back to the easier one then. What about this sowing the field with mingled seed? Now then, we have hybrid corn today. This would be forbidden under this. Should farmers be submitted in their agricultural practices? Should they submit themselves to Leviticus 19:19? Christian farmers or non-Christian farmers? You find that a little easier than the garment? Perhaps. Well, what about the cattle?
Then the guy thought of the idea of a mule messed up, didn't
it? Yeah. Yeah. Are these statutes here creation ordinances that are to be observed by the members of God's human race to set forth, like the principle of forbidding to have different breeds of cattle, and the different agricultural seed. Is God setting forth here that this is the way I want things kept separate? Or is this a type of the holiness that is given to the nation of Israel, in which they are to reflect that they are a holy, distinct people from the other generations or other nations round about them? We would ask ourselves this question here in regard to these. Were the Moabites and the Canaanites and all the ites there, were they then responsible for observing the breeding of the cattle and the garments and so forth? Or is this just for the Israelites?
The nation of Israel. It's the Israelites.
All right. Okay. Then what, if that be the case, then we do not have to find these here statutes as binding upon us then today. Follow that? That is, if this is to teach an Israelite that they are a holy, distinct people, and this is a ceremonial type here, then it does not follow that I am morally bound to wear a garment only made out of one cloth. But now let's apply one of these principles. One of the strong principles of covenant theology is that all revelation remains in force unless it is replaced with new revelation. Okay? Got me? Where in the New Testament is this commandment replaced?
It's not replaced.
Then according to the covenant position, if they are consistent within themselves, they ought to be insisting upon all three of these practices still being applied in Christian manners today.
But the New Testament doesn't prohibit them.
It doesn't prohibit them.
It doesn't prohibit
the practice of these.
Right. It doesn't say anything about continuing them on in the New
Testament. Yeah. All right. Now then, this one position, though, says everything continues on unless the New Testament negates it. The New Testament does not negate this. So if you are consistent in that position, then you ought to be arguing that the civil, the ceremonial, and all the moral laws relating to the nation of Israel are still to be binding upon the Christian church and the societies of the Gentiles today. Now, there is a position that is known for that advocate, and does anybody know what it is known as? It is known as theonomy, or Christian Reconstruction, which maintains that all of the laws that are given to the nation of Israel are a model both for the church and for the state. For Israel was a theocracy, remember? No separation between church and state. So that all those laws carry over and have an equity that are binding now, unless the New Testament specifically cancels one or more of them out. But do you see here, according to their own hermeneutic, they are inconsistent in that they're not arguing that the garments and the, at least most that I am acquainted with, don't go that route. I did talk with a friend that nearly all of you would know who he was if I mentioned his name, but he argued adamantly that it is a sin against God to eat hybrid corn. Now, why? Why would he argue that? Right here. Right here. See, he is trying to be consistent. And of course, he would also have major problems with the cloning and all of this today with the meat and the various animals and the interbreeding there. He would have a problem with that as well. I have yet to come across a person in practice who advocates the clothing issue. There probably are some that will do that. But I've yet to come across one. But if you're consistent with that idea that everything carries over, then here's a text of Scripture in which that the New Testament never negates this.
And they wear tassels on the bottom of their clothing, too.
What's that, Bob?
These people that separate the cloth, they also wear tassels.
Yeah. Now, let's go back through the remainder here of the chapter as quickly as we can. Verse 3, "You shall fear every man or respect every man, his mother, his father, and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Turn you not unto idols, nor make yourself molten idols. I am the Lord your God." Incidentally, all the Ten Commandments are alluded to in this one chapter, chapter 19, in different forms. "If you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord, you shall offer it at your own will. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it. And on the morrow it ought to remain until the third day. It shall be burned with fire." Now, what could we classify that particular statute as being if we want to follow that threefold division? I gave you the threefold division: moral, ceremonial, and judicial. What would we put those two verses under if we would go by that division?
Ceremonial.
All right. Sacrificial. All right. Then we could say then, well, that's ceremonial then. It doesn't have anything to do with us today other than Christ fulfilling that ceremony so that we do not have to bring animal sacrifices. What would happen to the Israelite, though, who refused to obey this precept? Would it be to him or her a sin? Look at it in the next verse. It's verse 7. "It shall be eaten at all on the third day. It is abominable. It shall not be accepted. Therefore, everyone that eateth it shall bear his" what? "His iniquity." Does that not sound like there's some moral implications here? Even though it's a ceremonial activity, if the person doesn't obey the command of God, then it becomes an act of disobedience, and that brings them under the moral displeasure of the one who's given the commandments. "Because he hath profaned the hallow thing of the Lord, and that soul shall be" what? And that's about as serious as you can get. That's either capital punishment or it is driving them out from the community of God's people. But the person is not to be permitted to live within the community of Israel. So you see, the ceremony has very serious ramifications of morality involved in it. Looking on down in verses 9... "And when you reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of the vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God." Now, what would we say that could fall under?
Giving alms,
all right. Here's a very practical thing, taking care of the poor. When the reaper went by, he would grab a handful of the stalks of the grain and he would make the cut. He'd have a handful. Whatever fell out was known as the gleanings. You remember Ruth? she came by and picked up the gleanings. That is, that was to be left for the poor. So here we have a practical application here of a statute of the Lord.
So which of the three is that then?
What's that?
Is that moral? Or is that ceremonial, or is that traditional?
I'm calling it just a practical application. It has to do with, again, Jesus summarized all of these laws into two. And what were they? Love the Lord. Here's part of your neighbor. So this is what helps me anyway. When I come to the bottom line of trying to struggle whether an Old Testament precept or command is to be obeyed by me today, I don't know how to answer it. I try to, Bob, apply it. How does this affect my relationship with Bob or Asa or Cora? How is this going to affect my relationship with my neighbor? And that gives me a definitive way. That is, if I'm wanting to do this for the well-being of my neighbor, then I know I'm within the framework. If I'm just doing it for me strictly, then I'd better back up and reconsider the issue. So here we have a very practical way. But still, if an Israelite didn't do this, Bob, it had moral ramifications. If he didn't leave this for the poor. So, again, we can't just put this into the neat categories. Verse 11, you shall not steal, neither deal falsely, nor lie one to another. Now, that's a pretty easy one, isn't it, there? What would we call that? Yeah. And is that only true for the Israelites? It says to the house of Israel.
But then Christ also in Matthew, I can't remember the exact passage also, but talking about shall not lie.
Yeah. Here we have something that goes beyond the nation of Israel, right? The gleaning is going to be associated with the land there when they get into the land. And the topography and geography of that, the agriculture of the land. But now here, we have then something that is stuck in here that goes beyond that of an Israelite. It's true of all men. Thou shalt not steal, deal falsely, nor lie. And ye shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of the Lord thy God. I am the Lord. Shall not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. Very clear thus far, right? Moral precepts. So that we could say that can we say that these principles that we've just read here, they're still binding upon how we conduct ourselves toward our fellow man today. All of us in agreement with that. All right, now look at the next part of the text. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. What you think, Walter?
Pay everybody after the day's work.
Huh?
Just pay after each job done or after each day's work.
All right, now, what's the question?
Financial system. You couldn't have checking accounts.
Is this the way finances are to be carried out today? If you answer no, then what's your basis for that? Because it's rooted right here in God's statutes. How can you take the first part of the verse and reject the second part of the verse? Do you see where the Christian Reconstructionists and the Theonomists are coming from? They're saying, let's be consistent. If we're going to take this. Or is this taking, now listen, a moral precept and applying it to a specific period of historical redemption? Is this period of honoring your fellow man by seeing that his wages are paid, is this now then being taken by God and applied to a specific time period in human history? I say yes. Otherwise, we are having to put new wineskin into old wineskins. New wine into old wineskins. Our economic system is not set up to where it would handle such a situation as this. Then would there then be something of a general equity which could be drawn from this? And what is the principle that is being drawn from this passage right here? Carolyn? What? See that your employees are paid. If you enter into a type of a contract, then abide and honor the contract. All right? So that carries on through there. Rather than requiring that there be a one day at the end of each work day, as was in that era, was the custom, then you make the moral principle apply to the economic system of whatever that we are in. Looking on, thou shalt, verse 14, thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God. Verse 15, you shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, shall not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. But in righteousness thou shalt judge thy neighbor. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, and neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbor. I am the Lord. Shall not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor, and not suffer sin upon him. Now these are all moral precepts here. Have these been discontinued? See? And if not, how do we determine that? And what I'm wanting you to see here is that in this one chapter, Leviticus 19, it's as if God has put a whole bunch of precepts in there, Brother Jim, and just stirred them up with an egg beater, to where that you have to look and see what is applicable to the nation of Israel, what carries over and what drops off, and then how do you make that decision? And that, my friends, is what the whole Old Testament is involved in when it comes down to ethics, is how do we make these decisions? Look in verse 18. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt what? Love thy neighbor. Now see, there's that moral precept there. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord thy God. Verse 19 that we looked at. Right in the sense of loving your neighbor, then the very next verse, he interjects this thing of the cows and the corn and the clothing. See, it's difficult in here. Look at in verse 20. Whosoever lieth carnally with a woman... I'm going to read this out of the New King James here. Whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed to a man or engaged to a man as a concubine, and who has not at all been redeemed, she's a slave, nor given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging. But they shall not be put to death because she was not free, as she's a slave. Now here's a man and a woman. They have sexual relationships. The woman is a slave. There is a misconduct here that God states, but it's not punishable by death. Now, but it is a sin. Look in verse 21. And he shall bring the man his trespass offering to the Lord to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, a ram for a trespass offering. The priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering before the Lord for his sin which he has committed. And the sin which he has committed shall be what?
Forgiven.
Shall be forgiven. Now look over in the book of Deuteronomy. Hold your location there, Leviticus 19, book of Deuteronomy chapter 20. I believe it may be chapter 22. Chapter 22. Verse 22. If a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then shall both of them what? What's that?
Put to death. Die.
Both of them going to be put to death. Why weren't they put to death back here in this other sexual sin?
She was a slave.
Okay. But does that, how do we handle the morality of that? If we hold that the sin involved is sexual conduct outside of marriage, sin is a sin, and yet here it is results in the death penalty in one, and the other case it doesn't. You see what I'm saying? The judicial law that God gave to Israel was not enforced across the boards in the same manner, in the same time period. And that has moral ramifications. Looking back over in Deuteronomy again. Both the man that lay with the woman and the woman, so thou shalt put away evil from Israel. If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed to a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then you shall bring them both out into the gate of the city, and you shall stone them with stones that they die. The damsel, because she cried not. That is, she consented, she wasn't raped. Being in the city, and the man, because he hath humbled his neighbor's wife, so thou shalt put away evil from among you. But if a man find a betrothed damsel, engaged a damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. But the damsel thou unto the damsel thou shalt do nothing, for there is in the damsel no sin worthy of death. For as when a man riseth against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so is the matter, etc., etc. Now I hope you're feeling some tension here. Because here we have the same act committed with different people on the part of men, and yet it's not punished equally. Now can you imagine what the American Civil Liberty Union would do with these things today? And they're in our Bible. They're in our Bible. And so the skeptics would say, all right, Mr. and Mrs. Bible believer, explain this to us. Why do you pick out one set of ethics and use this text out of the Old Testament, and why do you reject and drop another one? And if we say, well, one's moral, one's ceremonial, one's judicial, people say, no. In your Old Testament, you've got the same moral issues that aren't all handled in the same way. Let me leave this with us for next week. We come down to something a little more so we can get our teeth in. Is it a moral responsibility for a Christian to tithe? Now let's deal with that next week. All right? And whatever you come up with, bring with me your text for this. Okay? Let's handle it. Because we've got to... If you were a tithing individual, contributing to the temple, and here Jesus comes on the scene, does he automatically, he and his apostles say, now then, quit all your tithing? Does he? You say, well, we don't tithe because we're not under the law. What law? Well, the Mosaic law. All right. But tithe, Abraham tithe. That's before the law. Bring back your answer, okay, for next week. And let's just use that. Then we'll come back with the matter of marriage and divorce. And then we'll come back with the matter of polygamy. As we struggle in these matters of trying to determine, how do we determine what is still ethically binding upon us as Christians? Perhaps the Mormons are right. How do we relate to the Mormon claim of polygamy? When Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all practiced it, and David never once condemned for it by God.
When's polygamy? 2 weeks or 1 week?
What's that?
When's polygamy?
That's a particularly... I don't know, Bob, but I don't know how long it'll take us to get through tithing. Well, you have a particular interest in that? You want to explain why you have a... All right. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. It'll probably be 4 or 5 weeks, I would imagine. Let's just handle the one issue next week of tithing, okay? All right. Consider just any questions, maybe. Jim, you have had your hand up a couple times. I didn't get to recognize you. Well, any of the rest of you. Frankie, any clarifications or anything? We're just leaving more things unanswered than we are answering them at this stage.
Church of Christ, what is the major difference? Because I don't know much about them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the major difference? I know they think that they're not baptized. If they make a profession of faith, they're not completely saved until they're immersed.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. They are a merit. A salvation, you might call it salvation by formula. You do this, 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 about 5 things, and you may be saved in the end. No, no, that would be presumptuous. I remember the last person I talked with in that category said that the way God was going to judge him is that he would do the best he could and Jesus make up the rest. And so that was his belief system.
But that's a miserable place.
Well, it's not for a Pharisee. The person who really lacks self-righteousness and prides themselves in doing good, it can boost your ego in thinking, I'm thankful I'm not as those Baptists who believe they can live out there in sin and do all that. I don't do those things. I do this, 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 and this. Okay.
Well, they also think that they're the only people that go into heaven. If you're not a Church of Christ, you're outside.
That's the strict view of the Church of Christ. Not all of the ones that are in it now still hold to that, but that was Alexander Campbell and those founders. You've got to be in that particular church. Bob?
I've never seen it, I don't think, in the paper before, but just after you spoke on this topic 2 weeks ago, in the religion section, in the front page of the religion section, mentioned a debate between a lesbian preacher woman and a Church of Christ I'm not sure if he was a preacher, but teacher. And the article actually mentioned he would not be bringing the Old Testament texts in arguing against her lesbianism because... they were having a debate.
Yes.
Public debate. Because he was Church of Christ and that yes. didn't apply, but yeah. he would be bringing New Testament texts.
Yes, right, yeah. right, yeah. What they emphasize, when you come across the passages, you're not under law, but under grace, and then they are charged with teaching salvation by works. What they reply is that means works of the old law, the Old Testament law. But now we have a New Testament law that Jesus has given, and now then obedience or disobedience to that is what determines your destiny. So if when you charge them with preaching salvation by works, they said, no, we are not under the law. That is Moses and all the Old Testament. But we are under the grace, the new law of Jesus. And so he gives us a new set of laws, and those are supposedly easier. But my reading, I find Jesus' laws a whole lot difficult than Moses' laws, because they most of those even go to the heart. You could live in the time of Israel and obey the Mosaic law externally and still come short. And that's what Paul's problem was, wasn't it? Is that he was perfect as far as touching the law. And one more thing in closing tonight. The judicial punishments that were inflicted by the judges of Israel were not just for sins, but for crimes, because a sin was a sin against the state, a crime. And the only crime that could be punished was that which had been committed externally. The judges could not condemn you for what you were thinking. Get that? Now, what did Jesus really lay down in the Sermon on the Mount? Not that this was something entirely new, but what was he saying? If a man even what? Thinks in his heart. See, he's guilty of this. So that he is pressing the issue. You can't just judge yourself by external morality to a set of laws. It's what your attitude of the heart is toward God. Okay? All right, anything else? Well, let's be dismissed then. Okay.
I think I'll start putting this on...